Hey everyone, it is time for the latest episode of the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. Kaylee is here. I, Ben, am here. You've probably seen us doing these promos for the upcoming VF Pajama Party, which we're really excited about. It is, at the time you hear this, just about a week away on June 20th. So something we are getting very excited about. And as a result, we have somewhat of a special episode. It's a guest we've been wanting to get on for a while. But based on the timing, we're kind of slotting in a special episode right here. We got a lot of great feedback on our last episode, the first part of our two-part series talking about integrative medicine with Drs. Julie McGregor and Will Pendergraft. And the second part of that will feature Dr. Pendergraft and our good pal Brandon Hudgens, who, by the way, just ran a mile in 4 minutes and 2 seconds to raise money for the VF, which was pretty awesome. So you're going to hear that in our next episode. But for now, we're kind of splitting this up. For now, though, we are going to bring on a fan favorite, Dr. Peter Grayson. I don't know that it's really necessary to intro him, Kaylee, because so many people know who he is. But we probably should, right? Give him his due. But he has done so much in the community, and he has a lot of really exciting new research that he is going to share with us. That I am very. I know you are always interested into hearing about this new stuff, Kaylee. I'm pretty pumped as well to hear about all these new developments going on.
It's really cool. So yes, Peter Grayson, Dr. Grayson, people mostly know him, especially from the Vasculitis Foundation symposiums. But just to give you background in case you aren't familiar, so he is the head of the Vasculitis Translational Research Program at NIAMS, which is part of NIH, and has a medical degree from the Medical University of South Carolina. He has completed his residency at Boston University Medical Center, also has a master's in epidemiology, which is the study of disease and the cause of disease, from Boston University, and has been an assistant professor of medicine previously at Boston University before he joined NIAMS in 2013. So a lot of amazing stuff, and we're actually very excited to talk to him and hear about not only his research, but also, as you mentioned, his participation in the pajama party, which is about a week away.
He will be one of the many guests we have, and we're really excited for that. So yeah, stay tuned for more info, and you can go to our website, vasculitisfoundation.org, if you are just hearing about this for the first time. Should we set the record straight, Kaylee? You are not actually a kettle corn fan. I felt really bad. I felt like I outed you. It's really not who you are as a person. So for those who have not seen the promo, anyway, you will understand if you watch it, but I felt like I should mention that. Anyway, enough about us and the pajama party. We're going to talk about that later at the end with Dr. Grayson, because we have some great stuff to get to with him. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get right to it. Dr. Peter Grayson, he is coming up right after this here on the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. And let's welcome in now our guest on this latest episode of the Vasculitis Visionaries podcast. It's funny, we gave him this introduction and told you all about him. I feel like he's one of the few doctors, though, with the VF that works a lot with our foundation that really does not need much of an introduction, and that is Dr. Peter Grayson. So, Dr. Grayson, thanks so much for joining us. What have you been up to? I know you and Kaylee are in close proximity in Maryland on the East Coast, but how are things with you right now?
Things are just peachy. I'm in my house with my three young kids the older two just finished school. So we were doing the homeschool thing and balancing that with the teleworking thing. And it's been certainly interesting times, but we have been away from work for the last several months, mostly working remotely, which has been an interesting challenge, but also has been a really nice opportunity, because we've had a ton of data that we've accumulated in our program over the last couple of years. So we've been in full-on data analysis mode at home, getting time to just do some deep, deep analysis and really generating a bunch of cool ideas that we're extremely excited to get back into work and into the lab and start to test.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one thing that we probably all are wondering, and from, like, especially someone like me, not really knowing how the inner workings of your system are, and just how hospital systems are in general, where you have a pandemic and things are totally shut down. You're, as you mentioned, you're working remotely. I guess my initial assumption was that there wasn't going to be much in the way of additional research, additional things outside of COVID, just because that is such a huge thing and something that I would just have figured every medical professional would be turning all their attention towards. But it kind of tracking some of the things you guys have been doing, it sort of seems like that's not, maybe not entirely the case, and you've still been able to be really, really productive over these last couple months. So just bring us up to speed on what that reality has been like, how much time you've actually been able to still devote to a lot of these new research plans, and what sort of things you've been able to get in the works here.
Well, so my situation is a bit unique. So I'm trained as a clinical rheumatologist and I take care of patients, but I work at the National Institutes of Health and in what's called the intramural program. So when people think about the NIH, they think about it as a funding mechanism that is a branch of the federal government that gives out money for grants for research. But they keep about 10% of the overall budget for this internal program. And that's located primarily in Bethesda, Maryland, where there's a big campus and it's got full of all these different buildings and there's a lot of different institutes. And one of the institutes where I work is called the National Institute of Arthritis and Musculoskeletal and Skin Diseases. And we're kind of known for studying autoimmune diseases. And so it's a very unique place. It's where I work is a place called the Clinical Center, and it's the largest research hospital in the world. And patients just can't come in off the street. There's no emergency room. You have to be invited in under a study protocol. But once a patient is in there, it feels like a normal hospital. There's an intensive care unit. There's radiology department. There's outpatient clinics. There's inpatient hospital wards. But it's set up to function by providing clinical care and at the same time conducting research. And so intermingled with an outpatient clinic setting, you have research labs that are right there. And if you go down to phlebotomy and have your blood drawn for your clinical labs, they're also drawing labs for research. And the phlebotomy people are trained in how to draw blood samples in specific ways to support research projects. So it's a really amazing place. It's funded by, taxpayer dollars. And it is a place where a lot of important medical discoveries have happened over the last several decades. And I came there about, 8 years or so to start a vasculitis program. And there wasn't one in existence when I arrived. There had previously been a program that was started in the early 1970s. I know you talked about this a little bit, I guess, when Dr. Quinn was on your podcast, but that program was started by Anthony Fauci, who everybody, I guess, knows now. and he started it when he was a fellow, and they were credited with being one of the first groups that gave cyclophosphamide to patients with GPA, or as it was known then, Wegener's. And they ran this program for several decades until 2005, when it kind of shut down. And so when I arrived around, 2012, 2013, I was really excited to revive vasculitis research at the clinical center. One of the first things I did was I sent an email to Dr. Fauci, completely unsure whether he would even respond. And he responded within an hour or two and told me to come meet him. And I came down there and he regaled me with these stories of the early days of vasculitis research in the United States and told me about why they chose to use cyclophosphamide and how they picked the dose and all of these really amazing pieces of history. He asked me if people still remember him in the vasculitis community. And I said, oh yeah, for sure. He actually wrote, gave me a book, signed a book and gave it to me, which is something that I really cherish. And just to kind of give you a sense of what kind of person he is, he asked me to send him our research papers. And so from time to time, whenever we have what I think is a good paper, I will send it to him and he will email me back and comment on it. The NIH is this really interesting place that has a rich history of vasculitis research. And I'm there now, doing research, And so when the pandemic hit, you know, a lot of the research at the NIH is now focused on that. And people that aren't directly doing COVID-19 research are teleworking. And so we are home and really carrying on a lot of our research agendas as best we can and working really hard from home, but also, you know, bonding together and developing COVID-19 specific type of research agendas that are starting to get back up to speed at the NIH. You know, there's a weird vascular signal with COVID-19 that we're watching. So, you know, it's unclear to me whether these patients will develop something within the spectrum of vasculitis, but there are some suggestions of that. So we are definitely keeping an eye on it. And if that starts to happen, then we would hopefully like to get more actively involved in COVID-19 research. But until then, you know, there's a lot of patients living with a lot of different diseases and they deserve ongoing research attention. And so we're doing our best to keep our programs going.
And I think you mentioned offline that you have a new research program that you're developing. So I would love it if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and when I came to the NIH, I thought I was going to focus primarily on ANCA-associated vasculitis, and we did a lot of that. And what we initially intended to do was to identify factors that would predict relapse. But this was around the time that rituximab really started to be used, not just to induce a patient into remission, but to as a remission maintenance agent. And consequently, patients that were getting a lot of rituximab were doing quite well, and the relapse rates were very low, to the point where it was hard to study an event that never occurred. So we started to pivot a little bit and match what resources we had to diseases and particularly types of vasculitis where there was unmet need. And so we spent a lot of time over the last couple years doing a lot of research in large vessel vasculitis, primarily Takayasu's arteritis, but also giant cell arteritis. And then over the last 2-3 years, we started a new research initiative in this disease, relapsing polychondritis, which is an extremely rare disease that has almost been forgotten in terms of research and clinical care advancement. And the reason why we started to get interested in relapsing polychondritis is probably twofold. One is there is a physician who did her fellowship at NIAMS, and her name is Marcella Ferrada. And she's kind of made it her life's mission to study relapsing polychondritis. And she convinced me to join forces with her and to mentor her. And so together, we decided to build this relapsing polychondritis program. One of the reasons I was interested in relapsing polychondritis is because I consider it to be a form of vasculitis. About 10 to 20% of patients will have vasculitis, and it can be of the small, medium, or large vessel variety. But if you see a patient with relapsing polychondritis, they have features that are eerily similar to granulomatosis with polyangiitis to GPA. The hallmark feature of relapsing polychondritis is it's a disease where your immune system attacks cartilage structures. And one of the main places where you have cartilage is your external ear. And so these patients will develop a purple, reddish, swollen ear, and it's extremely painful. And over time, they can develop what's called a cauliflower ear, kind of what you see when you look at those wrestlers that have had their ear yanked on for a long time. Patients with the GPA, 5 to 10% of them will actually have this exact same feature of auricular chondritis or inflammation of the outer ear. And also patients with relapsing polychondritis will get inflammation in the nose and the septal cartilage, which can cause a septal perforation and can lead to a saddle nose deformity, which is one of the key hallmark features of GPA. So there's not a lot of things in medicine that will give you a saddle nose deformity, but RP and GPA are two of them. And then finally, relapsing polychondritis patients can get airway problems because your trachea and your bronchi are made of cartilage. And this is the thing that we fear the most in this disease because you can get into sort of life-threatening emergent airway situations. Some of these patients require emergent tracheostomies because of subglottic stenosis. Again, that's a problem that's shared by many, many patients with GPA. So unlike GPA, there's no ANCA autoantibody in RP, then there's really no effective treatment beyond glucocorticoids. Rituximab does not seem to work for relapsing polychondritis like it does for GPA. And when you take stock of relapsing polychondritis, it's kind of like where GPA was in the early 1970s. You know, there's no effective treatments. The disease is quite serious and can be fatal. And the only thing that we have that reliably works is prednisone, and these patients are getting a lot of it. And so my hope is that we can use this knowledge and this roadmap, this blueprint that's been laid out by GPA research, and apply it to RP. Because if you look at the landscape of where GPA is right now, it's quite amazing. I mean, there's a ton of effective treatments. We're reducing the amount of steroids these patients receive. There's a lot of breakthrough clinical trials that are happening, you know, every year. And we really hope that we can apply the same kind of methodology and have the same results for relapsing polychondritis, because that's a disease that certainly needs some attention.
I pride myself on knowing the pronunciations of all these, as you know, broadcaster, obviously, and now I've got to learn another one, clearly. So I'll just work on that in silence while Kaylee, while you continue. Relapsing polychondritis. I think I can.
You can just stick to the letters, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. Keep it.
I don't want to cheat, but yeah, that'll work.
I was going to say, I'm about to stick to letters. But for RP, so is NIAMS focusing on more of the treatment-related research? And if so, is it, you know, are there partnerships outside of NIAMS that you're considering in terms of what people are researching for drug development, other things like that? Or is it more looking at markers? What kind of research for RP is really
your goal? So how we started this? We started an observational cohort, which allows us to bring patients in at any point in disease. And we generally see these patients prospectively at 6-month intervals. And over the years, we've seen over 100 patients with relapsing polychondritis. So ours is the largest prospective cohort of RP in the world. And we help provide clinical care for them, but we have not launched the treatment trials yet. We're really kind of trying to understand the clinical aspects of the disease samples and trying to study the disease a bit in the lab. And we are, you know, applying standard of care principles and trying out different drugs to try to get a sense of if any medications are effective. We actually formed this international working group that is comprised of people that are interested in this disease. And we have people from Japan and India and Europe and around the United States, and we've really started to get together to do things like develop and validate classification criteria, to develop and validate disease activity indices, all of these measures that you need that are prerequisites to doing trials or clinical trials in the disease, but where you give treatments. So all of that stuff is in the works. There is an organization called the Relapsing Polychondritis Foundation, which has been this amazing grassroots organization that is promoting the disease and their patient advocacy group. And they've learned a lot from partnering with the Vasculitis Foundation. And the Vasculitis Foundation, I think, has been really helpful to them in sort of how do you get an organization started? How do you get this happening from the patient level? And they just announced that they opened a center, a new relapsing polychondritis center at the University of Pennsylvania that Dr. Peter Merkel and Sri Banerjee are going to run. And so that's awesome for us because our wait list of patients is quite long that are trying to go to the NIH, and we need more centers to be developed so that we can have other places around the country where patients can go and be seen. And the hope is to do all of this collaboratively to just get more and more sites and centers on board and start researching together. I can tell you that this is going to be the year of RP because we have this really awesome discovery that I can't quite share all of the details with, but we have figured out what causes disease in about 8% of these patients. And it's the same mechanism that actually can cause vasculitis in patients with polyarteritis nodosa and in GCA. And we're hopefully going to unveil this at the American College of Rheumatology annual meeting, hopefully this November. But I think that this is going to be an extremely exciting year for relapsing polychondritis research. And we've been working hard for the last 2-3 years to get to this point. And I'm really, really excited to try to be an ambassador for that disease and increase awareness for that disease.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And it's good to hear that this will be the, assuming it kind of comes to fruition, and it sounds like it will, the year of the RP. I feel like maybe not over this past year, but over the past couple of years, really, there's been a lot of talk of the EGPA being like the disease that has gotten a lot of attention from pharmaceutical companies and different sorts of research. And I'm kind of, I don't know, I'm a little bit wary, Dr. Grayson, of all the attention. I'm getting kind of uncomfortable. You know, I need a new disease to take it away from. But I also wonder too, and I know you said it's going to be some time before you start to see the patient introduction and the recruiting process developing. But I just wonder, first off, what that looks like for the current thing, you know, the additional things you're currently studying, and how that might look different, if at all, once you come around to that participant process and trying to figure out the right patients to get in, just with the kind of unique way that you were talking about earlier, how the NIH is structured just in general.
Yeah, I mean, we bring patients in. We have a broad research protocol that allows us to bring patients in who are, you know, age 5 or older with any form of vasculitis. And we bring, we study a lot of different forms of vasculitis. We see a lot of different patients. We try to see as many as we can. But we do go through phases where we turn our attention more towards one form versus another, just as the research kind of heats up and you start to get success and some ideas happening. There's still, our team is getting bigger, we're growing, which has really been quite fun. And there's a lot of doctors on our team. So Marcella Ferrata is really helping run the relapsing polychondritis program. And then Caitlin Quinn, who you guys talked to, is really helping run the vasculitis side of things and sees a lot of the patients with ANCA-associated vasculitis and with large vessel vasculitis. And we're trying to attract in more postdocs and more people like that into the lab and just grow. And, I think we've had, if you look at our research over the last couple of years, we've been very clinically focused, and we've almost been obsessive with trying to understand the full clinical spectrum of some of these diseases. We really do a lot of research that kind of subsets or subgroups patients within a disease, because we were looking to see, I mean, a lot of our premise is that most of these types of vasculitis is not one disease. So Takayasu's arteritis, I don't think is one disease. I think it's many, many different diseases that have damage to the large arteries in young people that then get labeled Takayasu's arteritis. But I think that there's subgroups. There's certain patients whose Takayasu may be driven by one specific factor. There's other patients whose disease may be driven by another factor. And so we have really just been trying to clinically categorize these diseases as deeply and as we can, and using novel available tools to see the diseases in different ways. But all of that is hopefully a setup for us to then start to understand molecular mechanisms and causes of disease in specific little smaller bite-sized groups of patients. And I think that's, that's where we're going to be in the next couple of years. And that's our hope, is that we can figure out, for some of these patients, we can figure out a cause. Because if we can figure out cause, then we can develop better therapies and we could potentially cure some of these diseases. And that's really the things that I'm interested in.
I think it's really fascinating to hear you talk about cause, because for me, that was something that, as soon as I learned that I had vasculitis, that was like the most important thing to me, even more important than, knowing what treatment plans I had and anything like that. I really just wanted to know the trigger. So I think it's really fascinating and important that NIAMS is doing that work.
And it's crazy too, because as you go on, you lose that a little bit. I think patients lose it and the doctors lose it. As you're used to having the disease, you start to turn your attention more towards effective treatments and ways of managing. We think a lot about ways to temporize disease, because that's where we kind of have success. But it's those big questions, right? It's the cause and the cure that we really want. And sometimes we can lose sight of it and just get sort of too focused on the smaller issues of these diseases. And my job has always been to try to kind of keep my head out of there and just try to balance these diseases at a very broad level. Like, what I've always been interested in is understanding the disease from the patient's perspective, down to the clinical aspects, down to the molecular aspects. And I think if you put all those together and step back a little bit, you can start to try to unravel and go after cause. And that's definitely where we're all about.
Do you have any tips you can give about causes and things you're considering, or are those things that will be announced at future conferences?
Well, we have a new causal mechanism that I think is going to blow the doors down on certain aspects of rheumatology, and I don't know how applicable it's going to be to a bunch of types of vasculitis, but certainly is applicable to a few of them. So yeah, I mean, we're looking in every which way. We're looking at genetics of patients. We're looking for, you know, signals in blood, signals in tissue. We're using advanced molecular imaging as ways to just see the diseases differently so that we can go back and look for different factors in blood, but not have to use our clinical impression of disease activity. We can use an imaging impression of disease activity because sometimes those don't align. Yeah, all I can say, it's my teaser, but hopefully if this work, you know, the deadlines for abstract submission to ACR are coming up and we're hopefully going to submit some of this stuff. And I really, my hope is that in November we'll unveil some of this stuff. But there's a lot of people out there that are finding cause of disease in vasculitis, and there's a lot of really cool work out there that's focused on that.
I'm really just excited to see what happens at ACR now. I think I'll have to go.
well, it's going to be virtual this year.
There you go. Even easier for me to go.
And it would have been in DC, so you would have been able to go without any problem. But you can now go from Rockville/Northern Bethesda.
Yes, Rockville. I firmly believe that it's Rockville, not North Bethesda. but I did want to just kind of circle back on some of the imaging technologies you mentioned. And I know, as you mentioned, Dr. Quinn also was at NIAMS, and she was in our fourth episode, and she talked about PET scans. And I know you also talked about PET scans on the Helio podcast episode you did with Dr. Adam Brown. And I just was wondering if you could go into that a little bit further, because from my basic knowledge of PET scans, just understanding that, okay, we're looking at these radio markers being uptaken by inflammatory cells. If we're getting rid of the inflammatory cells in our treatments, how does this affect your ability to use PET scans? And what does that really mean for that kind of research?
Yeah, so I'll give you the crash course, PET 101, because it's all I understand. The radiologist, they start talking to me about like nuclear physics, and I can't follow. So positron emission tomography, PET scans were classically used to detect cancer. And the main one that they use is something called FDG PET, which is fluorodeoxyglucose. That is basically sugar water. And what you do with the PET is you take your biochemical substance, in this case it's FDG, and you couple it to a radioactive isotype, and you inject it into a patient, and it hones to sites of whatever the target of that biochemical substance is. So when you're giving an FDG PET, you're giving sugar water to a patient. If they have a cancer, there's something called the Warburg effect, which is that the cancer craves energy because it has to rapidly divide and grow and expand. And so it craves sugar. And so these tumors will soak up this radio-labeled FDG, and then when you image them by nuclear medicine imaging, you can see sites of tumor. But what's very cool for immunologists and for rheumatologists is that it's not just cancer cells that crave sugar, it's actually immune cells, and particularly immune cells that are activated or that are inflamed, because these cells have a job to do. They're creating inflammation, and so they want sugar. And so when we are imaging a patient with large vessel vasculitis, we do FDG PET. What you're really seeing there is a sugar molecule that's going to a site that requires a lot of sugar. But that doesn't necessarily mean inflammation. And so this is the big paradox of PET, and this is the big question of what are we looking at. So if I take a patient with large vessel vasculitis, and FDG PET only works in large vessel vasculitis. I'm talking about giant cell arteritis or Takayasu's arteritis, because the size of vessels that are affected in something like ANCA-associated vasculitis are too small to visualize by radiographic imaging. So when you're giving that sugar water, you see it go to the walls of the aorta, and then we make an assumption. We make an assumption that there are inflammation cells in that wall of the aorta that are craving sugar, and that's why we can see it. But we don't know that for sure, and we can't biopsy the aorta. So that's always the challenge of doing these studies, is we're making an inference that we're seeing inflammation. But it could be, what you have smooth muscle cells in the wall of the aorta. What if they are metabolically active for some reason and they take up this tracer? So we're not 100% sure all of the time if we're seeing inflammation. Occasionally we get a patient who's not doing well, and we get a PET scan and we see activity in the aorta, and then they have to go to surgery for an aneurysm or a repair. And I can tell you in every one of those instances, the pet usually tells us the truth. It usually, when we see activity on the pet, we see inflammation on the biopsy or on the surgical specimen. But there is a healthy degree of skepticism about FDG PET from physicians. And that's one of the reasons why they're skeptical, because they think that sugar water is a bit nonspecific. I think after having done PET studies on patients with Takayasu and GCA for a number of years, I think we've done over 500 studies. I really believe that these are telling us clinically useful information. And I do think it is an appropriate surrogate for inflammation. We can treat a patient with therapies and watch their PET scan signal in their artery go away. We can stop those therapies and watch the PET scan signal rebound. If we don't treat when a PET is active, very often these patients will then get into clinical trouble down the road. But to answer your question, we don't know what specific cells are taking up this. So it's hard to know how different therapies would affect the scan. We do know that if you give a patient glucocorticoids or steroids and they're on it for just a week or more, often the PET scan signal will quickly go away. So these are the really big nitty-gritty challenges of PET-based research. And coming down the road is a field called immunoPET, where instead of doing a radioisotype to sugar water, you can do it to a marker on a specific immune cell. So wouldn't it be cool if you could tag B cells with an isotope and then image a person and see all through the body where there's B cells? And then what would happen if you gave that person rituximab that depleted B cells and you imaged them? Would you really be getting rid of all the B cells in the tissue like you do in the blood? And could we watch that and monitor that? Cells like monocytes or macrophages that I think are causing a lot of the problem in large vessel vasculitis, it would be very cool if we could tag them specifically and watch them over time as a non-invasive way to look at histology. I think that stuff is coming. But for now, we're in the days of sugar water.
It seems like, though, it ties into a little bit to what you're saying before, how just this idea of causal is so important now in research. And it just seems like we continue in this, and we, both with our discussion with Dr. Quinn that we had, like you mentioned, and with what you just said, it seems like we're following that path of trying to get smaller and smaller. And it just seems like we're from the research end of it. At least I get the sense that it's the right direction to go in, because you're learning more and more about these intricacies that previously you kind of just had to take your best educated guess at what you thought that overall impact was. So am I on the right path there? That this is kind of the way we want to go, and that as it relates to these, whether it's the new different types of vasculitis that can continue to be researched, or just the current ones we already know that we're trying to learn more about. I just get the sense that all of these different methods are at least kind of leading us toward a long and gradual path that is going to get more better results, I would think, at least down the line.
Well, I think we want to see the disease on the molecular level in addition to the clinical level. And, you know, like it or not, one of the hard truths of rheumatology, if you're a rheumatologist, is that most of the time you're giving medications in a trial and error kind of situation. And as you know, as patients, you give medication like methotrexate, it can take 4 weeks to begin to work. It can take 2 to 3 months to know if it's going to work. And if that drug wasn't the right drug for you, if it didn't work, then you're 3 months down the road and we're starting over and trying another drug. And, you know, in oncology, there have been light years ahead of where we are in rheumatology, because they incorporate molecular diagnostics. They take biopsies of cancers and they look for signatures at the tissue level that guide treatment decisions. We need to be doing the similar kind of things in vasculitis. I love the distinction small, medium, and large vessel vasculitis as a teaching point, but it's terrible from a biology perspective. It tells you nothing about what's happening in the disease. If you have EGPA, you know, it's great that you have EGPA and it's a form of small vessel vasculitis, but I want to know what pathway is activated in your specific EGPA so that I can choose the right medication up front. I want to know molecular classification of disease. And the way we use imaging is a surrogate for, you know, a look into molecular biology. But I want to be really clear that what we do a lot with PET is we're using it in a research capacity. We're using it to visualize pathophysiology of disease in ways that haven't been done before. We get asked a lot by physicians, okay, so how do we, PET sounds great. How do we use it? How do I use it clinically? And I do think it has a place in clinical practice, but our main focus has been trying to use these more as research tools. So that it's a difficult line to walk. And when patients come in to our research programs, what we try to explain to them is we want to live at the frontiers of clinical medicine. We want to use tools to see their diseases in new ways. And sometimes that creates interesting or difficult situations. For example, we take a lot of patients with large vessel vasculitis who are doing well and they're in clinical remission. Maybe they're 2-3 years into the disease. We've weaned them off their medicine. Their labs look good. And we do a PET scan on them, and they have what looks visually to us like severe inflammation in their aorta, but they feel fine. What do you do in those situations? And we constantly find ourselves in that kind of situation because we use novel tools to see diseases in different ways. But I think, and that's the hardest part of our job, but that's the way I think you make progress in clinical and translational research.
Yeah, I think Kaylee and I both feel the same way. It's exciting to just hear about this process and to just envision what will happen down the line. And I it's funny, I almost feel bad. I feel like we could do a whole hour just on this specifically. And, you know, I think about myself, an EGPA patient, and being now on multiple biologics. And it seems like the whole rise of the biologic in general has become such a big part of treatment. And then how does that tie in? And what can PET scans potentially teach us from the smaller level? So maybe we can make a pact,
Dr. Grayson. Did either of you have a biopsy?
Yes, kidney biopsy.
I also did as well, yes.
So what happens usually with your biopsy, it goes to a pathology department, they look at it. It's very important to make your diagnosis. Wouldn't it be cool, though, if we took a piece of that biopsy and actually studied your disease deeply at the molecular level and then used that biopsy for research? We're not doing enough of that in vasculitis. And vasculitis is a disease that where oftentimes there is biopsies are obtained because usually the gold standard is seeing the disease at the tissue level. And we really should be leveraging that additional tissue because not all the tissue is used. A lot of it's just sitting in a pathology bank. We need to leverage that tissue to learn about the disease because if we look in the actual areas where there's affected lesions, I think we'll learn a tremendous amount about how to be smarter with future therapies.
Yeah. That now that you mentioned it, it seems obvious, right? But, you know, tell that to in at least my diagnosis 2014, I can honestly say it wasn't the first thing on my mind as my biopsy was being done. And as I was on some sort of great combination of drugs that made me not really sure where I was, but that's neither here nor there. And like I said, I feel like we could continue this. Maybe we'll get a pact, get you on again, Dr. Grayson, at some point, and we can go into this in more detail because it is really fascinating stuff. The one other thing, though, that we had mentioned in our intro that I'm sure everybody is, it's really not the real reason they're listening, but is something they want to hear about is our upcoming event we have. And part of the reason we had you on as well is how much you've done for the VF and just the relationship you've had with them. So I wonder too. I think all of this is, as we've mentioned, is interconnected and everything. But with this work you're doing, how do you feel like it from the VF's perspective, how things have kind of impacted you in your ongoing research and all of this, and what sort of things do you feel like your involvement has kind of helped just push that that vision forward as far as all these new projects that you guys have been doing.
I think it's important to understand what the VF, what the Vasculitis Foundation does. I mean, they have a really wide mission. They promote awareness about the disease. They educate about the disease. They have symposiums where patients can come and interact with physicians and researchers and learn about their disease. They fund research, and particularly for early stage young investigators. They fund fellowships. So after you finish your subspecialty training, you can do additional years in training just specifically focused on vasculitis. I did that at Boston University under Peter Merkel. And they've even started to fund the development of vasculitis centers in areas that need centers that don't have them. For example, they were really integral in getting Northwestern's vasculitis clinic up and running. For me personally, you know, they got involved in my career right at the beginning and partnered with me and really helped me. They helped me recruit patients for studies, and they continue to do that. They invited me to talk at the patient symposiums, which gave me a platform to speak about our research directly to the patients. There's not enough opportunity to do that. We do all of these studies, we take samples from patients, and it's very difficult to directly communicate back to them what we found. And the VF is a really good platform for that. At the patient level, they connect patients to doctors, and that is really helpful. If you're a physician caring for, you have a patient that comes in your office, you diagnose them with vasculitis, but you want to get them to a specialist, what you should do is go to the Vasculitis Foundation's website. They have a find a doctor feature, and you can look anywhere in the world. I get calls and say, you know what, I've got a patient in Western Australia that needs a vasculitis doctor. And if I'm not intimately aware of the region, I go right on the Vasculitis Foundation's website and look and see who's around in there and who do I know. And try to connect the patients with a physician. And probably the most important thing of the Vasculitis Foundation, and you guys can speak to this much better than I can, is that they connect patients to each other. And I think that's really invaluable because we know from a lot of research and from talking to patients that they have a very different perspective on their disease than their doctors do. They prioritize things differently. You know, they're very much thinking a lot about the day-to-day aspects of taking prednisone and about the fatigue aspects of the disease. And these are things often that are, you know, recognized by physicians, but perhaps not directly addressed during a busy clinic of a visit when you're trying to, you know, assess if there's organ threatening damage and things like this. But learning the tricks of the trade from patients, getting comfort from patients who've already been there and been down the road. I'm sure you guys, what is your guys' experience? Have you done that with new patients that have come in through the VF?
Yes, I think Ben can probably speak to this a little bit better than I can, since he's been involved with the young adult group a little bit longer. But that is really the purpose, is to really initiate the newly diagnosed, I would say.
Yeah, so much of it, I think, for us, once you've been in the community for any period of time, it's almost serving the purpose of trying to help that newly diagnosed patient just sort of come off the ledge and not totally freak out. I think there's something to be said for that, because it is as much of a mental battle as it is physical when you go through that. So yeah, I'm glad you point that out, Dr. Grayson, because yeah, it is a big part of what we do. And yeah, you just think about, if you can just help one person think of it help them be strong, they can kind of share their own experiences. And we have seen that. It has worked out where patients we were just introduced to as when they were teenagers are now in their early 20s, kind of from that first wave 4 or 5 years ago when Kaylee and I both started with the young adults. And now they're at least confident enough to be able to talk about their own experiences with some of the other younger people. And especially now that we're getting more and more, as we've mentioned, just with the slow improvements we're getting in diagnosis, there's definitely more people that we can help out with that. And there will be a lot of people at this upcoming event too, which is I feel like my super organic way of transitioning us into
pajama party.
I know, right? I guess I should stick to my day job of being a broadcaster, because that's what I do. Cheap, easy plugs and transitions. Kaylee, on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited are you for Dr. Grayson's performance for us at the PJ party?
So excited. I've seen the teasers on social media. I'm ready. I'm ready to see it live.
So over a 10, that's how I'll interpret that. Yeah.
You didn't give me which was the positive and negative end of that scale, so okay. I thought I'd be safe.
what should we be expecting, though, from this? I feel like there's a lot of different directions this thing could go.
I think I should ask you guys that. I mean, I saw your promo, both of your promos on YouTube, and I want to say first, Ben, I would go with the blue kimono for sure.
Okay.
I'm going to be there playing some music, playing some guitar, and I got my kids in tow, who are going to play some music with me. But I feel like I got it easy. I mean, you know, if you think about these events like the Oscars and such, it's the host that get all of the attention, and it's the hosts that make or break the show. So are you guys, as hosting this thing, are you feeling the pressure? Are you nervous?
You know, there's definitely something to be said for going outside your comfort zone. I definitely felt that strapping on the silk robe and then filming myself. So, as far as that objective, I think, you know, I think we've made it there. But as far as the actual night, you know, I'm not too worried. I'm not that nervous. We have a great team behind the scenes that we've teamed up with from the VF that have kind of led us through the whole process. So, I'm more excited than anything. I don't know how you feel, Kaylee.
Oh, I'm excited as well. I think any event that I can eat snacks during is really my type of event, so I'm ready.
Is there going to be some sort of opening, you know, show tune number, monologue, tap dancing, top hats and canes kind of thing?
What do you think, Ben? You're ready?
Well, we've got, at the time people are listening to this, we've got just about a week to figure that out. So we could, you know, I can say TBD on all of that. And, you know, I can, we'll be creative. We can tell you that. That is going to be featured in it. And I think more than anything, what'll be nice is to just, I mean, to bring the community together and get everybody in one place and understand that if I embarrass the heck out of myself, which I'm sure I will, it's for a good cause, right? And we're raising money, people are laughing, it's a distraction, it's a benefit to everybody. So I think that's the way you kind of have to envision it if you're wondering the host mentality to, you know, give everybody a peek behind the curtain.
Well, not to brag, Ben, but I did do high school theater, so you might want to step up your game.
It's, you know, it's a shame to your point with you playing music. And I like I said, I'm looking forward to what you and your kids have to offer there, Dr. Grayson. But I'm regretting that I did not keep my saxophone from the high school jazz band. I don't have I cannot be a help as far as musical stuff.
Oh, yeah. But it's a song and dance number that the community is looking for from you.
Yeah, I know. I'm aware. We'll
brainstorm. We'll take it offline.
Yeah. I think your assignment is to, like, look at every wasn't Billy Crystal, like, the best Oscars host or something? Wasn't he universally recognized as the best? You're going to have to pull out the old film and just start looking at it.
You know, I would say that I have a busy plate and that it will be tough for me to do that. But everybody knows that would be a lie. As a sports broadcaster, I have nothing on my plate. So that, I guess, I now have no excuse to avoid. So yeah, I will do my best. And we've now devolved into basically just bullying me into embarrassing myself even more. So you've clearly been by far the most successful of our podcast guests, Dr. Grayson.
I mean, you brought out the kimono, kidding. Not me.
That is a fair point. Okay. I'm glad that we did this at the end of the podcast. I'll say this instead of the start, or else we would have scared everybody away. So I'm glad that we at least got the meat, the good stuff that people really care about.
I don't know. I feel like this is the extra hour that we need to do.
Yeah.
The outtakes.
Yeah. I feel like Kaylee's getting off a little. I think because Kaylee is the, you know, masters of public health and the smart one in these that I feel like I am being placed with the burden of look like an idiot on the we actually end up doing the pajama party. So I just want to make a public statement on that.
We're all getting outside of our comfort zone, and it's going to be quite a night.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can all agree on that, and I hope we can get you on our podcast again in the future as well, because as we've seen, this stuff is always changing, it seems like. I mean, with the research, and there's always new things to talk about. I'm always curious to get your thoughts on a whole wealth of stuff within our community. So it's really great to have you. And I know we're all of our listeners are appreciative of you sharing some of your insights in what's obviously been a pretty crazy time for everybody.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
All right, thanks again to Dr. Peter Grayson. Just fascinating stuff, and it kind of leads us into the excitement we both have, not only for the pajama party, Kaylee, but just for the future of research as a whole. There's reason to be optimistic after hearing the all the different things that they are doing with NIAMS, the NIH, and from Dr. Grayson's perspective. So awesome stuff, as usual for him.
Definitely. I am excited to attend ACR in November. It's going to be incredible if that podcast was anything to go off of. So it'll be really interesting to hear more of what they're working on.
Yeah, I'm proud of you, Kaylee, because I know you're nerding out incredibly hard, but you held it in. You held it together. You
didn't. I did. I swallowed hard.
Yeah, no fangirling, but I appreciate it. You're very professional, and we'll see how that carries over to the pajama party next weekend. I'm pretty excited for it, and I feel a lot of pressure now to really step up my game. So you'll all have to stay tuned to see what happens. Isn't that right? But
absolutely.
Alas. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we also want to thank our sponsors before we go. I don't want to forget them, Genentech and GSK, for making this episode possible. And again, stay tuned. The next episode we'll have, it is part two of that series of talking about integrative medicine. We'll have Dr. Will Pendergraft back with us, and also bring on Brandon Hudgens, our good friend, colleague, member of the young adult vasculitis community. A really fun chat with those two that we are excited to bring you in 2 weeks' time. Of course, go to vasculitisfoundation.org to register if you haven't already for the VF Pajama Party. And that's the next time we'll see you guys. So thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you at the VF Pajama Party.